This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me tonight is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
So tonight, we couldn't avoid it, really, Rich. It's our sort of superhero special. We're going to be looking at the Snyder Cut of Justice League. Then we're going to look at, in our short shot, a new Batman short film called Dying is Easy. And then we're going to go back to the 90s for Darkman 2, The Return of Durant. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is Zack Snyder's Justice League. Following the death of Superman, Bruce Wayne attempts to bring together other super beings to help defend Earth from future threats. As he and Wonder Woman try to convince the likes of Aquaman, The Flash, and Cyborg to join their cause, a powerful being called Steppenwolf arrives seeking three Mother Stones, which will help bring about an Armageddon. Are they Mother Stones or Mother Cubes? I can't remember.
Mother Boxes.
Option three, Mother Boxes. okay, so, you know, I saw the original theatrical version.
Yes, Joss Whedon.
Which Joss Whedon finished. Obviously, Zack Snyder started it. He had a tragedy with his family and couldn't continue. So the studio got Joss Whedon to step in. He rewrote a lot of the script, made it a lot shorter, changed a lot of the special effects in the film, and put out something which met with a sort of lukewarm reaction, I think.
How did you feel about it when you saw it?
I thought it was very stagey. You know, every single scene looked like it was shot on set.
Exactly what you mean.
Even the outside scenes.
There's a bit where they're all standing on the grass at one point in the film, and I just remember thinking that just looks so fake.
Which is very strange.
Cheap.
That's kind of how it came across. I love the characters. You know, I thought Ben Affleck as Batman / Bruce Wayne. I thought he was really good. Ezra Miller? Is Ezra Miller?
Yeah, it's Barry Allen.
Barry Allen. And, you know, the guy playing Cyborg. Sorry, I've forgotten his name.
Ray Fisher,
who, you know, he really got short shrift in the original version. He, you know, as we see in this one, you know, a lot of his stuff was cut down to the bare minimum to make room for everyone else, I guess. But this is a much more expansive story, I was surprised at how much had been changed from what we saw, you know, and how much of Joss Whedon's stuff was kicked to the curb. Really, you know, the whole ending, that, you know, the whole thing with Superman at the end, the whole thing with Barry Allen at the end, was completely different, you know. It was much more enjoyable, but at the same time, there are issues here, aren't there?
Well, I mean, for what are the issues for me? The long running time for me wasn't really an issue.
No,
I actually quite like the fact that it's got that epic scope to it. I mean, it's a bit off putting when you're going into it, but I think it definitely holds its own. You know, the running time works. You know, I watched it in one sitting I was completely engaged for the whole time, which was very much not the case with the Joss Whedon version, which I, as I say, just felt cheap and, you know, just not very engaging at all. Didn't really care for any of the characters or anything in that, but part of it was curiosity about, you know, what's this going to be like? I mean, when it was first mooted, you know, that it was coming out and that, I really wasn't that bothered. But then I heard a review and they were sort of saying, hang on a minute, actually, this is really good. And I thought, well, I'll have to give it a, you know, I'm going to make an event of this. I'm going to, you know, focus on it as much as I can and give it the time. And yeah, I think it does work. I think there's bits, you know, one of the things that doesn't work for me is like the quite indulgent, slow musical sequences.
How many times do you have to hear the Amazon lament? I know, you're absolutely right. No, especially in the first hour, there are a lot of sort of like folksy ballads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think, you know, it's almost like it's like Johnny Cash, but not kind of thing, though, you know.
Well, they've got covers of like Leonard Cohen. And,
yeah, exactly. And, yeah, that's exactly the sort of stuff we're thinking about. How do you feel about the aspect ratio?
Ah, now it's a good point. This was another thing that completely threw me. Was when I saw the trailer, I was like, "Well, that's weird. Why is the trailer got black bars at the side?" Yeah. And then I should have realised that that was the intention of the movie, that it was going to look like that. So that's a major departure for any, you know, big blockbuster. And quite what they did with the Joss Whedon version, I'm not sure. I mean, I believe that all the footage was shot in this Academy ratio box, you know, format, and they cropped it. I'd be fascinated to look at some side by side scenes, you know, of the stuff that retained, because apparently the majority of the footage in this, which is in the UK version, which due to PAL comes in at 4% shorter, so it's like 3 hours 52 minutes instead of like just over 4 hours, but the film itself comes in, it finishes at the 3 hour 44, about 3 hours 44 minutes. The majority of that, I think about 3 hours of it, is footage that was not used in the Whedon version. I'm not 100% on that, but that's kind of what I've heard. So that's kind of the ratio is, I went with it and I was fine, but I must confess, I would prefer if it was a traditional widescreen black bars on the top and bottom letterbox look. For me, that's more of a, that's more what it's about. I mean, the idea of this being made in that way for IMAX theaters seems a bit limited, because you're putting all the focus on making a film that will fit only a portion of the theaters that are actually going to show it. So that seems to be that's an unusual choice. Definitely.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, after a while you get used to it while you're watching it.
Yeah, I mean, the last film I saw with that ratio was Lynn and Lucy, which is like, you know, it's a British kitchen sink drama kind of thing. It's not the style you would expect a big Hollywood movie to use. I mean, no. Nobody else has done it. So in that way, it kind of, it's Zack Snyder sort of putting his firm stamp on it, you know, that it's going to be something both familiar and very different. You know, it's got that really long running time that we're not used to. It's in a different ratio than we're used to, but you've got that anchor of all those familiar characters and everything. He's not doing anything too, in terms of the story and what happens with the characters. You know, this isn't Watchmen. He's not breaking any rules here. This is very much conventional stuff. It's handled a bit more seriously than it might be in, say, the Joss Whedon version or in an Avengers movie, which is, you know, it's easy. I mean, this is basically Infinity War, as far as I'm concerned. It's the whole setup and the plot and everything is basically, you know, Thanos and whatever. It's all exactly the same, as for me.
Basically,
I don't really see much difference.
It's very, very familiar, except... You know, they're having to put the team together now rather than, you know, this is the different, there's two differences between Marvel and DC or between Marvel and Warner Brothers, shall we say, in that Marvel introduced us to the characters first and, you know, built up the team and then presented it with the big bad threat. This one just tried to jump straight in with the team, you know, putting them together, putting everyone's origin stories into it, and then sort of facing off. The other thing, I mean, not so much for this film gets another thing right, which the subsequent films have gotten wrong. So things like Wonder Woman and Aquaman, for example, are very much standalone films in that they are totally isolated from the rest of the DC universe. Yeah. Whereas a Marvel film, you would have other characters making a cameo.
Yeah, crossovers and stuff. Yeah,
little crossovers. Yeah. Like Ant-Man, for example, you've got the Falcon in there, you know, just sliding him in. You know, Thor, you've got Doctor Strange, for example, you know, just little things, just sort of like, yeah, these, you know, this all exists in the same place. Whereas, you know, the other sort of films just don't do that. They're focusing on this one character. No mention of Superman or Batman or anything, or Metropolis or anything like that going on, which I think is a detriment, really. If you give that little insight, they're saying, yeah, we acknowledge that all this other stuff's going on at the same time. What this film did right, you know, it had time for, is that not only is it sort of focusing on the main characters, but it also throws in other known characters. So, you know, we see a Green Lantern turn up at the beginning, in a flashback. There's another well-known Justice League character who turns up later in the film. He gets two scenes, in fact, which is really cool. A very well-known villain turns up at the end. Anyone who's watched CW's The Arrow series, you know, the Green Arrow, will be very familiar with that particular character. Actually, so will anyone who's seen Suicide Squad, but there you go. So you know, it's acknowledging and putting these little nuggets out there, which, you know, can be grown upon later on. You know, it can be grasped upon and expanded, which I thought was really good. So I thoroughly enjoyed that.
So in this case, we've got a kind of a Tarantino chapters kind of approach, although in this case it's parts. That's another thing that I didn't really feel that was necessary to do, though. I mean, in terms of making it episodes, if you wanted to release it as a series, so for example, in Poland they might release a movie about 2 hours long and then they'll show a six-part TV version, which is much longer, equivalent to this, basically. So in terms of that, I think doing that works. But in terms of the film experience, I didn't, you know, watching it all in one go, I wasn't that bothered about the cards sort of signifying the beginning of each part of the story. It's not a major problem or anything. I didn't really feel, you know, the quotes and things that they use for the titles are quite, to an extent, sort of, it's, I don't know, oblique or not particularly.
Well, they're all sort of like lines from the film,
like little quotes and stuff. Yeah, it's like I don't know if you did that help you in terms of when you were watching the film. You know, you could say, oh, that's the end of that bit. Okay, I can have a break now. And
we kind of did, because as I said, we watched it in two halves. So yeah, when we got to chapter four, that we just said, okay, let's call it a day now. That I think that was like 1 hour 54 minutes. You know, so it was almost at the halfway point. I thought, yeah, okay. So, you know, from that point of view, I do remember reading something that they were, you know, I think this has gone through a lot of transitions as to how it was going to be presented, because HBO ran with this in the States. And I think, you know, it was talk of it being a mini series at one point. And I think they maybe, you know, the residue of that idea, you know, that we'll divide it up into six chapters and sort of six separate episodes. Well, let's be honest, seven episodes.
Yeah, because you've got the epilogue.
Because the epilogue is almost as long as all the other bits.
Yeah.
But we'll come on to that in a minute, I'm sure. The cast I thought were great.
I did like the Flash and Cyborg a lot more than I did in the Whedon version, especially Cyborg, which I didn't connect with his character. He didn't interest me at all. Whatever, I thought they got a lot out of him in this version. So that, I think everything benefits, you know, for all the characters. You know, you get to know them a lot more and sort of be much more interested. And even the supporting character, like Joe Morton as Cyborg's father, and we get Martha Kent has a few scenes. I'm not sure if she was in the Whedon version or not, but we've got Lois Lane. Yeah. She's actually not really in it very much, even in this extended version. She's only got like a couple of moments. Yeah. And one thing that did bug me a little bit was you are expected to know where things got to at the end of the last film, which I haven't seen for a long time. Yeah. And so things are kind of kicking off from that start without any context, and you've kind of got to keep up. And I was thinking, okay, so they show Lex Luthor with Steppenwolf and the Mother Boxes kind of thing, or Steppenwolf in doing something at the beginning, don't they? When the Mother Box, the shout goes out and it starts waking things up. So they show him there with Steppenwolf. Is that from the end of Dawn of Justice?
I don't think he's with Steppenwolf.
Is it not Steppenwolf? He's with someone anyway in the beginning part, and then he disappears from the movie entirely, and then turns up at another point, let's say, in a completely different set of circumstances. So I was a bit thrown by that. I thought there might have been a bit more going on, and I wondered if maybe that's a clip from the previous film that I don't remember very well where things got to.
Indeed.
As to because he's the reason Steppenwolf came, isn't he? Or something. He's done something.
No, well, I mean, the reason Steppenwolf comes is because Superman dies, as they say in the film. Yeah, because they were messing around with one of the boxes beforehand, or Star Labs were.
Yeah.
But it didn't wake up because Superman was still there. But as soon as he dies, that's when they start waking up. We got a free pass now.
So what was Lex Luthor was like wading around in this water or something in this like cavernish sort of space, and there was a monstrous creature.
Yeah, he creates this creature from using the power from the mother box and the sort of amniotic fluid in the ship and this sort of stuff. So,
And that was in Dawn of Justice.
Yes.
Right. Now, okay.
The other thing this film makes clear is that the director's cut of Dawn of Justice is the canon version, because it's the director's cut which features Batman's fever dream of the future, which the epilogue in this one goes into as much detail and gives us a very sort of eerie look at this sort of alternative dimension. And we're not sure whether this is something they've managed to avert or is something we can look forward to in the future.
Yeah, because I've never seen that extended version of Dawn of Justice, because I don't know, was it ever released over here?
I can't remember, but I do recommend it. I mean, it's the only version I've seen. And I thought, why is everyone ragging on this film so much? It's actually really good. I actually really liked Dawn of Justice, apart from the sort of Martha bit that a lot of people keep going on about, but it's actually a lot stronger than you'd expect.
Yeah, it's the ultimate edition, apparently had over 30 minutes more in it. I think it's possibly available somewhere. It's not easily, something I was able to track down. I'd be very interested to see it, but in terms of, this film was the first time I'd seen those sequences.
Yeah,
and they sort of come a bit out of left field, and I sort of wonder where they fit. Really, to me, those kind of didn't belong. I felt a bit.
It is weird because when Cyborg sort of first. When they're about to wake up Superman, and sort of the boxes are trying to, or something's trying to tell him not to do it, and he gets these sort of visions of Wonder Woman sort of being dead and being put on a funeral pyre and things like this, and Superman with the red eyes, and it's like, well, is this something they've managed to avert? Is this like an alternate timeline? Like the sort of twin Earths kind of thing, Or is this something which is sort of inevitable and is going to happen sort of further down the line? It's difficult to say because it's still a bit sort of obtuse.
Yeah, because you wonder how is it, I mean, we've got that sequence with Cyborg, but then we've got Batman having his dream.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, where is that coming from? Where is that, you know, how is that happening? I was a bit detached from there. In terms of the Mother Box thing, they're basically supposed to be boxes inhabited by demons or you know, ancient evil, you know, sort of creatures, apparently. Which, and they kept calling about, you know, these three mother boxes and whatever. And I couldn't stop myself thinking of the three mothers, you know, the Dario Argento thing. Yeah. And whether the, I don't know if there's a connection there in terms of it's the same mythology, the same sort of idea, but, you know, interpreted in a very different way. But it sounds really weird, mother boxes and stuff.
It seems clunky, doesn't it? You know,
yeah, it's a bit like the what's it and the Allspark, in Transformers and stuff like that. You know, the
Unobtainium,
yeah, from Avatar, yeah. So, yeah, it's a kind of that is a bit cheesy or whatever. I mean, Infinity Stones is probably not much better, but yes, yeah, I'll just skip over to Steppenwolf for a second. He looks a bit rubbish in the first version, and the special effects are much better. Again, they've done kind of a Sonic the Hedgehog thing, really, where the people reacted badly, so they've invested a load of money and whatever to.
Well, I mean,
make it look a lot better this time.
I did see even when Joss Whedon, you know, after his version came out, there was some comparisons, you know, because obviously they'd filmed stuff. Mm. With the Zack Snyder version, and you know his design is a lot more intensely detailed. You know, with this all the sort of prickly armor and stuff.
Yes.
And even Cyborg, you know, his outfit is with Joss Whedon version is a lot more sort of smooth and sort of streamlined, whereas this one sort of all different angles and stuff. You know.
Ah, so I didn't even think that they changed. I didn't even think that they changed Cyborg.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, he got sidelined more or less, didn't he?
Yeah, that's it. He was barely noticeable, wasn't he, in the original? Fascinated to go back now and watch the Joss Whedon.
Yeah, actually, so am I. Yeah,
because I want to see what the difference is.
There are some omissions. I was sort of. I wish they had left in. There's one bit I'm glad they didn't. There's a bit where Aquaman, Arthur Curry, starts sort of spouting off, sort of going, oh, this is a very foolish mission, we're all going to die, I don't know. He's like, oh, I don't know why I'm saying this, and he sort of looks down and he realizes he's sat on Wonder Woman's lasso, which is a joke lifted straight out of one of the animated films with one of the Wonder Woman animated films which had Nathan. So when I saw that, I thought, oh, you've nicked it from somebody else. So I was kind of annoyed by that. But there is one really good line that Joss Whedon came up with, and it's an exchange between the Flash and Batman, where the Flash is sort of having a bit of a sort of crisis of confidence. And so again, I'm not a hero. I can't live up to what you guys do. And Batman sort of goes, all you got to do is save one person, and then the next person, and then the next person. And you get the hang of it, sort of thing. And I thought, you know, that was a really cool line. And I was sort of, you know, I felt it was missing from this. But other than that, you know, that's the only bit I sort of like really stuck out to me that I thought, yeah, that actually worked. But other than that, one sort of little observation which sort of popped up on Twitter today, sort of various people talking to, Timon Singh actually mentioned this. When you got that, you see like the Atlanteans and the Amazons have really sort of like went to town to sort of like safeguard their mother box, you know, with these elaborate sort of like safeguards and stuff. And then mankind basically just digs a 3-foot ditch and chucks it in and goes, yeah, that'll do. But at the same time, that proved to be the more difficult one to find, you know, the one that doesn't have the elaborate traps surrounding it. So, yeah, that was quite funny.
That is very, very silly.
It was a very, very silly moment. So, actually, here's an interesting thing as well. A while ago, we had as a guest on the show, a bodybuilder slash actor, Daniel Steisen,
mm-hmm.
from Germany. He had a small role in this.
Right, okay.
Yeah, he was one of the guys knocking out the support struts in the, where was it? Was it the Atlantean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, he had a sort of small scene as sort of one of the muscle men, sort of like, you know, smashing the hammers. So yeah, quite interesting.
Yeah, we've also I noticed in the when the cast list was coming up at the beginning, I saw David Thewlis on there. So I'm guessing he was playing the same character he played in Wonder Woman.
Yeah, but I didn't spot him.
I did. He was in the flashback.
Okay.
When they went to the when this happened the first time part,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. He only appears very briefly. I don't think he even had any dialogue. I'm not sure. No. Maybe I missed it, but didn't seem to be. I don't know why they credited him. To be honest, you would have thought they would have just sort of left that as a cameo, sort of Easter egg kind of thing. But the cast is excellent. I don't know how many of them were not in the Whedon cut, but. I like seeing J.K. Simmons as Commissioner Gordon. I just think it's funny that he's got these roles in both universes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
J. Jonah Jameson in the Marvel.
Spider-Man's, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was quite fun. The Amber Heard turns up from Aquaman. I believe this was her first time playing the character was when she filmed these scenes.
Right,
so she's got an English accent, and then when they later did the feature film, solo feature film, they changed her to an American accent. So there's those little differences, little changes and that. But I just think it was very entertaining. I was very gripped. You know, gripped is the wrong word. You know, I went along.
Yeah.
With the, you know, I was taken away by the story and the visuals of the character. Say the apart from the fact that it's not shot in a ratio or presented in a ratio that is my preference. That's really probably a minor quibble.
Yeah, I think that and the fact that it all looks so CGI. You know, so actually somebody else mentioned the fact that. You know, it's almost as if this is happening during the Marvel blip, because there's hardly anyone around in any of the scenes. It's just like really bizarre. The whole place is just like really underpopulated.
That didn't occur to me, but I love it. I definitely want to watch this again. I'm really interested to take another look at it.
I agree with it, and I want, you know, I do want to sit down watch the theatrical version and then watch this back to back. Well, not back to back, because that's what, 6 hours of TV of movies in one.
Yeah, scene. This is
on close proximity for sure.
Yeah, Sky bought the rights to show it over here, so obviously that's a massive coup for them. Because one of the things that I think also makes the difference in watching this is it's a real event that this is coming that it's coming out. You know, it's. Okay, it came out before in another form, but you know, this technical what we consider it, this is a DTV version of it. You know, it's a special version that's not theatrically released. It's coming at a time where we've only had one major blockbuster in the last year, basically. I mean, Tenet is essentially all we've had. So we haven't had this big blockbuster film experience. You know, this is
right,
kind of
yeah.
there's a huge swell of desire and interest to see a big, you know, epic scale movie. And I think that is another, you know, key factor in, you know, sort of approaching this. I mean, had it come out at a time, a normal season, I think it would have still been very well received. But I do think that sort of, it just makes the experience of it just that bit different.
Yeah.
It makes that a bit more special for this moment in time. You know, it's really, it's the zeitgeist film of the,
yeah.
of the time of it coming out, and I think say it's going to probably do really well for in HBO in HBO Max in America and Sky over here. You know, big surge of
free trials
if nothing else.
And I think also like create a bit more sort of buzz for Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead coming up to Netflix in a couple of months as well.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. I mean, yeah. I'd be interested to see what the running time's going to be there. I mean, the fact that he's made this nearly 4 hours long, I mean, I don't think a few years ago this would have ever got released anyway. He wouldn't have been in the same way as Dawn of Justice and whatever. They would have cut it down and then they would have later released this version as like a special edition. I think it would have been
interesting, isn't it? Because in not Infinity War, Endgame was 3 hours long.
Mm.
You know, and that probably sort of did open the door for this. You know, the fact that everyone was willing to sit through 3 hours of superheroes.
Yeah.
You know, someone's going, okay, yeah, maybe we'll do it. So yeah, it's great that this, you know, whoever put the money up to finish this off and give him the the creative control to build it the way he wanted to build it. I think it proves that, you know, I mean, I did have issues with some, you know, with Man of Steel, the whole Americana kind of thing, you know, it sort of drove that home a bit too much, but. This and Dawn of Justice, I think, are quite well done. And I was like really worried about Jesse Eisenberg being Lex Luthor because of that clip in the trailer where he's like really hyper.
Mm-hmm.
But in the film itself, he's a lot more measured and thoughtful and scheme. You know, he can see the microchips in his head sort of like working. You know, he do really get the feel of somebody who's, you know, working sort of four steps ahead of everyone else. So yeah, he's actually really good as Lex Luthor.
Yeah, again, it might be that I say the theatrical cut with Lex Luthor in Batman versus Superman could have emphasized those characteristics more, because that's definitely kind of a big takeaway of when you're watching it. You're like, oh, he's doing that. Oh, I'm kooky.
Yeah,
I'm,
that's oh, right. Yeah. But yeah, no, you get the more sort of quieter scheming scenes, and he's completely different. Yeah.
Oh, what in terms of additional scenes for characters? Mm-hmm. How? What did you think about like Jeremy Irons and the whole tea thing?
I thought that was all right. I thought it was, you know.
I liked it.
he's obviously, you know, showing him to be like a micromanager almost. You know, he's like he can't just let it go.
I think they're emphasizing his Englishness saying tea. I mean, a bit of a cliche, but saying tea is really, really important. Yeah, exactly. And how you present, how you make it. you must put the water in.
Yeah.
Was it? You must put the water in first.
Don't burn the leaves.
Don't burn the leaves.
But there's another really good line as well that when Bruce Wayne introduces the tea, when he goes, "Oh, this is Alfred. I work for him."
Yeah,
it was a sort of nice way of sort of putting their sort of relationship as well. So yeah,
Do you like Ben Affleck as Batman, and do you like Henry Cavill as Superman?
Yeah, I do with both actually. You know, I think when I saw, which film was it now? Which is the one that had the epilogue scene with Ben Affleck? Where was that? Was that in Suicide Squad?
It might have been. I haven't seen Suicide Squad, so I can't.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
You put me off that one.
Well, yeah. There's a lot wrong with it, but the epilogue of Suicide Squad had Bruce Wayne meeting with Waller, and it was a brilliant scene. You know, and it really showed him as being this sort of driven sort of character. So I was quite on board with him as being Bruce Wayne. It's a lot different to the sort of Bruce Waynes we've had in the past. Mm-hmm. I think he's been really good. I must admit, I'm looking forward to seeing Robert Pattinson in the next one. Mm-hmm. You know, the trailer they put together, considering they'd only filmed a quarter of the film at the time, I thought, he looks vicious. He's a very vicious Batman. Could be really interesting.
I don't mind. I've got used to it. I don't really mind. I don't love Bruce Wayne's Batman suit and stuff, and and I'm not that bothered about him and Henry Cavill. It's fine for me though. The movie is stolen by Jason Momoa as Aquaman and Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman. I think they're much more appealing characters. I don't know if that's because they're not fighting against former interpretations, although both obviously have had, it was a Wonder Woman TV series and all that sort of stuff, but they're both kind of a clean slate more than Batman. Batman's been played by different actors, that's right, but at the same time, like on TV and whatnot. I thought the bank terrorists, they're going to explode, blow up the bank kind of sequence at the beginning. That's amazing. I've heard that in the Joss Whedon version that I don't remember, that was a much less intense scene, but this one, it's like full on, it's that scene when you're watching it and you're like, right, this is the DC for grown-ups version, not the DC for kids. Like when you watch the DC animated movies and suddenly there's people being shot and there's blood everywhere or whatever, and it's like, this isn't one for the kids. This is real threat. But I don't think the rest of the movie kind of follows through on that intensity.
No.
I mean, it's kind of, it's got, oh, there's another big threat. There's not really anybody around. Is it, at least it's not a beam of light, but.
There is that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but how are you going to score this one anyway? We're going to score it.
Well, I mean, I think I'm judging it for, enjoyment and interest and what the sort of coming at this time and, the sort of special kind of experience that it is, and the fact that I think it's worth revisiting. I think I'm going to go a 9 on it, to be honest.
Interesting. I'm going to go a bit more conservative and go with an 8 though. Mm-hmm. I do want to see it again after I've seen the theatrical version, as we mentioned, just to sort of compare, and even go back to Dawn of Justice, if I can find the sort of the director's version. But anyway, if you probably would have guessed if you online, people are raving about this. There's some very sort of strange comments out there from people who are sort of in the Marvel camp, shall we say. But this has created a hell of a lot of buzz, and you owe it to yourself to check it out, especially if you didn't enjoy the theatrical version. This is a much, much different kettle of fish altogether. So a 9 and an 8 for Zack Snyder's Justice League. Our short shot this week is Dying is Easy. Batman receives word that the Joker, currently incarcerated at Arkham Asylum, is dying and travels there for one final confrontation. So this is a 30-minute short. It is rather, rather good. So very high production values, Rich. Mm-hmm. A very good Batman. He's got the right sort of voice for it, for the role, very much like Kevin Conroy, but with a bit more sort of grit to it.
Yeah.
They do a great job with the sort of the other characters. We've got Michael Madsen playing Bullock. There's no Commissioner Gordon, unfortunately, but
There is.
Is there?
He was on the telly.
Oh, right, okay.
Played by Casper Van Dien.
Really? Shit.
Yeah. It's a blink and you'll miss it.
All right. Okay. Now, there's another sort of blink and you miss sort of character in this one, which we'll mention shortly. But this handles the franchise really, really well. I mean, obviously, it's a non-profit film, not associated or affiliated with Warner Brothers or anything. But they're obviously fans of Batman, proper fans of Batman. They know the material. And they know how to put together a very good short.
Yeah, have you seen any of their... This is from Bat in the Sun. Have you seen any of their other films?
I think I have, because the name is very familiar.
So I'm going to read a couple of the titles. They've been doing this for about nearly 20 years. They did one called Dark Justice in 2004. Another one called Patient J, which I think is very much sort of... they seem to have gone back to a couple of the ideas from that film in this one. Patient J is just about the Joker, but it's like an... he's being interviewed, and it's very much an interview kind of setup in the same kind of way that Dying is Easy... The centerpiece of the movie is this conversation, or not quite a conversation, or more like a monologue from the Joker to Batman. You know, that makes the core. But they did that, and then there was one called Batman Legends, another one called City of Scars, which is kind of where they were starting to go with this version, like the longer stories, doing something over more than 20 minutes. So and bringing Kevin Porter in as Batman. Seeds of Arkham was another one, which I think was more of a trailer kind of, you know, set up. Probably they were trying to get interest on a potential web series or something, and that didn't quite happen. But for the last almost 10 years, their focus has been on like these versus videos, like YouTube.
Do they do the Batman versus Darth Vader one?
Yes, they do all that stuff.
Yeah, that's the one I saw. That was brilliant.
So they get fantastic stunt people and whatever involved. I mean, there was one I watched yesterday or the day before, which was the Winter Soldier versus Nightwing, I think. Mm-hmm. And the Winter Soldier is played by John Morrison, John Hennigan.
All right.
So, you know, so he, and he's great. Obviously, he's very... you know, it's a fantastic sort of physical performer. Mm-hmm. So they got, you know, polished, you know, professional people. They're getting involved in some of this stuff. And this is culminating now with this latest project where they got Michael Madsen in quite a key role. I mean, he's how much he's bringing to the role, I'm not sure, but they have got him in two key scenes that sort of bookend the movie. But yeah, it's. I mean, the thing that happened with this one is, for the first time from what I've seen, you know, basically looking back at the other films, is we've got we see the Batcave, mm-hmm. we see a Batmobile, you know, big visual effects kind of stuff going on. That's kind of stuff they've never, as far as I can tell, they haven't gone that far before. The one-on-one fights, you know, the fight scenes. Is you know, they're really strong with that because they've been doing it for a long time, and the film opens, you know, within the first 2 minutes you've got this really intense action scene, which I loved. I mean, for me, the movie peaks there. So I wanted more of that
a little bit. Yeah, I mean that particular scene, you know, it is as strong as any sort of Ben Affleck bat fight scene.
Yeah.
You know, it would easily...
Christian Bale.
Christian Bale. It would easily fit into any of the films. Yes, it's a shame that it happens right at the beginning, because it's the only one we get. I mean, you know, there's some nice interplay within the film itself, but you know, we don't get that sort of visceral sort of element after the first sort of couple of minutes.
Yeah. But, I mean, Kevin Porter as Batman, for me, is... you know, come out of, because I've never seen him until this film, and going back and watching the others, he's kind of come out of left field as like an ultimate Batman for me. I mean in this movie, another thing they've obviously invested a lot more money in than previous projects is the suit. I mean the suit is blockbuster movie quality, as far as
it's
I could
funny
tell.
Looking at that, and you know, because we were just sort of looking at the Snyder Justice League, and how much better the suit looks in this.
I think that, yeah,
because Ben Affleck's suit still looks homemade, you know. Especially in the, you know, in the flash forward bit at the end, there's just something sort of very homey about it.
Yeah, which is, like, I know, I get that's all part of the kind of aesthetic that they're trying to go for, which is funny, because that's the weird thing about the Nolan films, is like they're quite grounded, but at the same part, some aspects of it are really, really fantastical, you know, and his suit and everything.
Yeah, they I like the way they get around it in like Batman Begins, you know, with the cowl and things like that. It's like, well, we got to hide the fact that, you're getting this company in like Vietnam to make it for us or something. It's like, so you got to order like 10,000 of them.
And then it's like, oh, there's a defect, so we've got to order some more. But Kevin Porter, I mean, he fits the suit. I mean, he's massive. I mean, Batman looks enormous and threatening in this, and he's an angry Batman. So it's like the Christian Bale thing. He's like growling kind of Batman, but he plays it really well. And he's not just played him in these movies. He's for this the guy who runs the company. I think they're brothers, Aaron Schenck and Sean Schenck. Aaron Schenck plays the Joker in this as well.
Yeah, so we can talk about the Joker.
Yeah, we'll get to him in a moment. But Kevin Porter played Bruce Wayne. He didn't even put in the Batman suit. He just played Bruce Wayne in a short called Truth of the Mask, which was a follow-up to another short which he wasn't in called Riddle of the Mask. So these were all focused on like the Riddler. And in that one, he plays Bruce. And he's so different. And I watched like a YouTube video where he was, you know, talking to people trying to, you know, because this is all like crowdfunded kind of, you know, Patreon kind of stuff. And he was talking to people. You know, he just sounds like a regular guy. And then he just puts on the voice of Batman. He just transforms. It's really, I mean, it's like a Patrick Warburton type.
Yeah,
that's sort of where... what I was coming, so he was great, and then so the story moves from seeing the Batmobile and stuff. We meet with Michael Madsen, and then it's on the way, and then we're off to Arkham Asylum, and we meet before we get to the Joker. We meet several other key characters along the way.
So we got the Riddler, played by Doug Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And we got Poison Ivy, of course, but also we got Harley Quinn, played by favorite of the show, Amy Johnson.
Which I did not realize until I was looking through the credits here on the. And Jamie Costa was the Mad Hatter in the open, because the opening sequence is an Alice in Wonderland kind of thing with Mad Hatter.
I thought that was really cool that they went with the Mad Hatter. You know, that they decided to go with a known villain, but not one of the obvious ones, you know. So you take away the Penguin, the Riddler, and the Joker, he's probably the next one alongside Killer Croc or someone like that.
We also see Mr. Freeze, nice little visual effects. Most of this is done like in one shots, you know, we just see them very briefly. But I think it adds a lot more. It adds even more sort of value to. I mean, they're all.
It's kind of what we're saying about, you know, the Warner Brothers DC movies, in that, you know, that they're just so stovepiped, whereas this one, you know, it in very short scenes, it's like saying, yes, here is the whole Rogues Gallery. We acknowledge these people exist. It's not just Batman that we're playing with.
Yeah, because I think was it in Batman and Robin where they go to. They go into like the closets or something, you know, like the storage room, and instead of showing actual characters, they just show like their stuff, their props, and that. So you don't, you know, there's the little nods to, oh, there's Riddler's cane or something like that, but you don't actually see the characters, because then that brings in a whole other thing. So with this one, they're like, no, throw in everything, and then so that is those are like the appetizers. Before we get to the encounter with the Joker, played by the director Aaron Schenck, who usually plays, he's played like characters like Dick Grayson and Nightwing in previous films. I don't think he's played the Joker before, so this is kind of him. You know, he's the director and writer, and he's been making these for a long time. This is probably something that he was kind of. I don't know whether he was working towards it or whether he. Decided that he couldn't get who he wanted, so he was gonna have a crack at it. I'm not sure, but I wasn't a big fan of his interpretation of the Joker. How did you get on with it?
I thought it was actually really good. It's sort of somewhere between sort of Cesar Romero and a bit of Mark Hamill in there. You know, but also, you know, going to the comics, you know, the sort of Killing Joke slash Dark Knight slash you know, Death in the Family sort of versions.
Yeah. Well, all the short films they've made are basically stemming from that that universe, that version of it. I mean, the Patient J short is very low budget, but the there's a lot of invention and creativity, and so they do these like flashback sequences. So we get the origin of the Joker kind of thing from Killing Joke, you know, where he's wearing the Red Hood stuff. So that's all quite nicely handled. And they, in this one, they don't do the cutaways that they did in that, but it's a similar approach. It's an encounter and him sort of, you know, showing off basically. This is the Joker, you know, performing for his audience, in this case, performing to Batman. And his mannerisms are very poised and particular and stuff. And I'm not sure. I get what he was going for. I'm just not sure whether that was a particular style, because we have it for like 8 minutes. You know, the sort of encounter lasts that long, and for me, it was kind of a bit. It just wasn't working for me in the way. You know, I've had that massive, you know, big fight scene, and now I'm spending time with the Joker, and I'm not as engaged with it. But then the chain comes out, and it all gets a bit more interesting for me.
Yeah, no, I thought it was pretty good. I think there's one sort of clunky line of dialogue when he's describing the death of Dick Grayson, which is covered in the animated film Death in the Family, which I haven't seen yet. And he says something like, "Oh, you know, when I beat him up with the lead tire iron or something," I think. It's like, well, choose one. It's either it's made of lead or it's a tire iron. You're not going to get a lead tire iron, you know, or a crowbar, I think he said. It's a lead crowbar. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't get a lead crowbar. But there you go. Other than that, I thought it was fine. It's interesting, both this and the epilogue in Justice League were referencing the Death in the Family storyline.
Yeah.
To go to Batman, but this one also goes to the Killing Joke. It's quite surprising, actually. You know, the photos; those photos are integral to a part of the Killing Joke, and it was quite interesting seeing them in this.
Where were the photos? Remind me.
Photos of Barbara Gordon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, basically. Although in the Killing Joke, it's a lot more sort of explicit, obviously.
Yeah, I would say that, I mean, going back to, you know, referencing Justice League, obviously everyone knows that Jared Leto turns up as the Joker. I hadn't seen Jared Leto's Joker before. That's the only time I've seen him play him. And I didn't like it at all. This is a much more Joker, like, you know, this is a proper Joker performance, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I do prefer some of the other interpretations, but I can't criticize, you know, the presentation of the character. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Justice League, you could have not called the character Joker. You know, it felt so detached from him. As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, the thing about Jared Leto's Joker in Suicide Squad, for example. Mm-hmm. Is that it's the first time you get the impression of him as a gang boss.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, you know, everyone else, you know, even with Heath Ledger's version, you're kind of wondering how he's managed to convince people to work for him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Jack Nicholson, you can totally get it. You know,
exactly.
People are going with him, and that all works. Plus, there's a kind of artifice to the whole thing anyway, so you can just kind of go with it. But yeah, the whole, I mean, there's a few problems with the Dark Knight that, you know, just don't quite work, but we're not going to go into that. But yeah, that does make sense. I mean, I'm curious in a way to see the role, the see Suicide Squad and that, but I've just heard such bad things. I'm not really that enticed.
No, it's an interesting one. I'm very intrigued to see what James Gunn does with the material. next.
So going back to these guys, and you know, there's lots of other characters appear in it as well. I mean, the stuff that I would have missed. I mean, fans will be all over this sort of understanding who Hugo Strange and and obviously recognizing the. I mean, apparently the Condiment King appears. I didn't spot him, but I'm not overly familiar with.
Not aware of that one.
With that particular character. But for me, the big takeaway of this is, although it's a film that mainly focuses on the Joker, it is that sort of revelation of this fantastic new Batman that I wasn't familiar with before. I mean, I think Batman is I mean, he's not used a lot. He doesn't do a lot because he's kind of just a forceful presence more than, you know, he does a few lines and everything, but he's kind of the, as it always is. I mean, look at the 1989 Tim Burton Batman, you know. Batman got second billing to the Joker for a reason. And that's kind of all the way, it's the way it will be, that, you know, the clown is always going to be the sort of the main one. But I just thought he had such a powerful presence, and the suit, and they got everything right. And that fight scene is where he ends up stamping on the Mad Hatter. And I mean, it's really good. I mean, it really sets an amazing, a real tone. You realize this is a Batman for grown-ups, more grown-up than the Nolan stuff, you know, that heading towards, you know, an R-rated kind of version of the character. Sort of
like Frank Miller style Batman.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I'm hoping that they continue. I've no doubt they'll make more, but I hope that this sort of acts as an impetus to get an even grander project off the ground. And you know, I'm not saying that we you know, we're never going to get like a, well, we might get a full-length feature, but you know, these things are usually quite
well. I think it'd be another Encounter at Xenos scenario.
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? Yeah, I think they would be struggling.
Yeah, because you know, if they get too big for their boots, then Warner Brothers will, you know, they'll never want to admit that somebody else is doing a better job with the material than they are.
Yeah,
so. But there you go. Yeah. So they'll never acknowledge this, I don't think, which is a shame.
No.
But it exists.
What did you think of the Batmobile and stuff? You know, like that.
The Batmobile was really interesting because, you know, it's sort of along the lines of the animated version and also, you know, the Tim Burton version. But it's sort of bigger. It's sort of somewhere between that and the sort of more, you know, the crawler kind of thing that. We had with the Nolan version. But what really interested me was how battered it looked. You know, this wasn't a clean, gleaming machine. You know, this is something that had been through the wars. It's sort of loads of sort of scratches and scars along the sides of it, which I thought was really good. You know, this looked like a very sort of weathered tool of Batman's.
Yeah, well, I think this is kind of the, you know, it's that Dark Knight Returns kind of. You know, Batman's been around for a really long time. You know, he's probably quite old now, kind of thing. He's, you know, I mean, he's already suffered losses and whatever. So that those are kind of the indications there. I think that's what they're going for. Alfred wasn't in this, was he? I don't remember seeing Alfred.
No, I didn't have an Alfred. No,
that was him.
Well, one of the other things they do as well is, I mean, one of Batman's other names is the Dark Detective. And we actually get a bit of detection work in this one. Which is nice. You know, I think that's one of the criticisms of the new Batman is that he's not an actual detective as such. He's just there sort of beating people up and from one fight to the next. So it was nice to sort of see him actually using his intelligence to, you know, come up with this sort of elaborate plan. And, you know, when you see that sort of prologue or that, you know, the fight scene, then it jumps ahead 2 months and it's a completely different storyline. You're going, okay, where's this going? And then you forget about it, and then it sort of ties it all in quite nicely as to what's, you know, why we're doing, why we had that opening scene.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's very, very good. Definitely worth checking out.
And before we move on, I would say when people are checking this out, there's another short that I found, which I'd like to recommend. And it's called, it's from 2012. It's called Puppet Master. And it fits beautifully into the Nolan Batman universe story. It's got that real world, you know, quality to it, and they introduce a couple of characters and they interpret them in a very different kind of way. And the way it's made, the way it's filmed, they've got like the Christian Bale version suit. So they've gone to town, and it's about 10 minutes long. There's some nice treats in there. It's a really very solidly made little movie. I'd love to see more. You know, it seems that that's the only one they've done. They've gone on to, I think they've gone on to do Harry Potter fan films and stuff. But that I do highly recommend that one as you know, to do a little Batman double feature. But the Patient J, I just mentioned again, which is like a touchstone for Dying Is Easy. I think that is really well worth watching as well. I mean, it's a much lower budget, earlier, rougher production, but it's got some really good stuff in it. So they're really worth seeing.
One I want to recommend, and we mentioned it earlier, is the Batman versus Darth Vader one.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that one.
I haven't. I really need to check out a lot of these.
It's kind of like, you know, the whole confrontation between Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader at the end of Empire Strikes Back. Mm. But instead of Luke Skywalker, if you put Batman in that situation, it's really, really good, because he's using all these sort of subterfuge and misdirection and stuff that you know that he would use in that sort of situation. Mm-hmm. It's just really, really well done. Absolutely loved it. So we'll put the link to Dying Is Easy into the footnotes. So please check it out, and, you know, spend some time having a look at, what are they called again? Bat in the Sun. Yeah, have a look at their channel. They got loads and loads of stuff. I'm definitely going to be sort of spending a bit more time looking through their things. I'm sure there's plenty of other good nuggets in there to check out. Our DTV throwback this week is Darkman 2, The Return of Durant. Robert Durant manages to recover from his injuries inflicted on him at the end of the first film and returns to the head of the crime family with an eye to take over the arms business. The only person who might be able to stop him is Peyton Westlake, aka Darkman, still trying to invent a synthetic skin which will last longer than 99 minutes. I've seen the original, obviously, Sam Raimi with Liam Neeson in the main role of Westlake. This time we've got Arnold Vosloo taking over the role, and I think he's really good in this. I have to say, I'm a big fan of Arnold Vosloo. It's a shame he sort of disappeared after the Mummy films. But there you go. He's really good in this, and who's the guy who plays Durant?
That is Larry Drake.
Larry Drake, of course. Dr. Giggles.
Yes.
Et cetera, et cetera. So he's really good in this as well, as you'd expect. It's got an interesting look to it. I think people who are unfamiliar with the backstory might be a bit lost at times. But I think this is, you know, it's on a par with the first one. I don't think there's a lot missing from it, sort of production-wise.
No, I think it is quite impressive, considering that this is a TV, more of a TV quality follow-up to a big blockbuster. What's particularly notable about this one is that it was kind of the one that started the DTV sequels trend, as far as I'm aware. I don't remember another one of a similar ilk coming out. I mean, this, you know, you'd have other versions, you know, follow-ups and stuff on TV or whatever. But this one was a low-budget film, but going for, you know, it was an 18. You know, it was going for it. It was, you know, hard R, I guess, in the States, I presume. But, you know, it's violent, the swearing, you know, it's not skimping on anything, which was quite unexpected at the time. I mean, normally you would expect that this would have been made, it's made for the video market, so they would have made it PG or you know, something like that. But they've made it as a real follow-up to the first film. Yeah. With the limitations that they've got with director Bradford May, who's an experienced television director. And I think they get the aesthetic you know, they do it really well. I mean, the colors and the visuals and the sets all look really good. You know, even though they're, you know, you can tell they're working on a budget, but it just works. And Larry Drake is kind of the ace in the hole. I mean, in the first film, he, which they show at the beginning, because there's an exposition dump at the start. He got basically, effectively, he was killed. He was killed because a helicopter hits a bridge and there's no way you would survive that. I can't remember who it was, but somebody was saying how he basically got out without a scratch. so he returns because they could get him, basically, because the film needed a big anchor. And Larry Drake was a big enough name, so they could put his name above the title, which they couldn't do with Arnold Vosloo. We mentioned in a previous episode about the main character in a film being credited as "and," you know, as an afterthought. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what happens here with Arnold Vosloo. He is the main character. He's the main star of the movie. Obviously, Larry Drake is the scene stealer, but he is the main character, the protagonist, and he's in the whole story. He's not just turning up for a little bit, but they don't credit him, you know, high enough as far as I'm concerned, because he did a great job.
Yeah, totally agree. Liam Neeson,
Like the Liam Neeson one, you see. That's the thing about the Dark Man thing. I didn't really care for Dark Man. It didn't mean much to me. But Dark Man 2 came out at a time, you know, when I was, you know, formative years developing interest in, you know, direct-to-video movies and stuff. And, you know, reading about it in magazines, a very exciting time. And I watched it and I loved it. And I go back and watch it now, all these years later. It holds up. It's, you know, it's really well made. It's very interesting. You know, the performances are solid. The story is good fun. You know, what more do you want? It's like a good time. Yeah. And there's just a couple of little niggles I've got. And it's a niggle I had then, and it's a niggle I have now. Peyton Westlake is supposed to be dead.
Yep.
They've recast the role. So why is he still, why are they saying that he's using his real face? Why is he not dressing as someone else? You know, it seemed like a perfect opportunity. You've recast the role and you say, this is the identity I have assumed now. Instead, he's
make sense, wouldn't it? Like
face, going out to meetings and expecting somebody to not say, hang on a minute, aren't you Dr. Peyton Westlake?
Exactly,
do you know what I mean? So that sort of, that jars a bit. I can't remember and that retconning of, you know, the whole Larry Drake surviving, you know, that thing, you know, but I can forgive that, you know, just, you just got to go with it, you know, it's just kind of a bit fun. But so imagine like a TV movie version, if you've never seen it, imagine like a TV movie version, but they've amped up the violence and stuff, which is, this is predating, as far as I know, this is predating things like HBO and whatever. You know, nowadays we've got Titans, which does this thing, which does, you know, the 18 rated sort of TV series thing, version of superheroes. You know, they're all you know, it's quite a common thing. You know, The Boys, you know, all that stuff. But at that time, nobody had really done something for home entertainment.
Yeah.
With this kind of budget, you know, and this kind of marketing, you know, this profile. So I think that's what makes it stand out. Because the film, you know, it's a made for home entertainment thing, because it comes up at the start. It says MCA Home Entertainment Presents. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't hiding the fact that this was not a movie that was intended for cinemas. This was marketed as a, you know, home viewing experience. But and I think it works really, really well.
There's elements, you know, they kind of want to make a sort of comic book superhero movie without really knowing how to do a comic book superhero movie. So you know, there are some sort of comic book elements in it. For example, the evil scientist guy who comes up with the, you know, the new weapon. Dr. Hathaway, you know, he gets broken out of prison. And things. So you got this sort of evil scientist guy, and then the henchman working for Durant, for example, are both very good. Yeah, the main guys, the Russian guy.
Yeah,
I thought he was really cool. So you know, they got these sort of elements, and they also got the bit at the beginning where he you know, he stops this sort of this armed robbery kind of thing going on. Mm. Well, he doesn't really stop it; he just profits from it. But you know, it's a typical sort of superhero sort of moment, and it's the last sort of thing he does. It, as far as that sort of storyline goes, you know,
that's true. Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to that. I mean, another criticism I would say is the plot is very close to the original. Mm-hmm. Right, you know, it's basically the same thing happens again, but it's not to Peyton Westlake this time.
Yeah,
it's the same Robert Durant, you know, trying to strong arm the scientist. Killing him off, except in this case, it doesn't end up being another dark man. that's the only difference.
I'm pretty sure in the first film that Durant wasn't the main bad guy, though.
Oh, was he not? Sorry, I've probably missed.
No, he was, you know, he was the main evil guy.
Mm.
But he was actually working for somebody else. He's working. There was the girl in it who was Liam Neeson's girlfriend,
Frances McDormand.
Yeah, her boss was the main baddie.
Right, okay.
In the original. And Durant was sort of like a, you know, his strong arm guy, basically.
Yeah, okay. So I've misremembered that bit, but the essential thing of a scientist is...
Mm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is killed because he won't give them what they want kind of thing. Is that they've just retreaded that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They could. Now, interesting thing is I've read that Darkman 3... which was the third and final one to date of anything they'd done. Darkman 3 was supposed to be the second one.
All right.
And then they switched them around. I think it's because Darkman 3 is not... I don't remember it at all. That says there's nothing particularly notable about it. It stars Jeff Fahey as the villain.
All right. Yeah.
But I think they knew... And this is just my theory. Mm-hmm. I think they knew that it wasn't going to do that well.
Yeah.
And therefore, people wouldn't be interested in the trilogy, you know, the trilogy being rounded out with the return of Durant, which would make sense in terms of a trilogy thing. That's kind of what they, you know, that would be quite a common thread. So they've said, actually, we're not going to do that. Let's go straight for Durant.
Yeah.
And then we'll put the other one out afterwards and try and benefit from the buzz that this one gets from, you know, due to Terry. That's my theory, is why they would have chosen to do it that way. I mean, other DTV sequels have, had that kind of thing happen. So for example, Art of War 2 was made with Tretch, I think, but they ended up shelving that because they managed to get Wesley Snipes to come back. So then they made another Art of War 2 and then released the other one as Art of War 3 later. So there's the sort of financial, or you know, sort of the decisions that come around, because you know, I understand why that one happened. It's because, you know, Wesley Snipes became available and said he'd do it. This one, I think it's a bit harder to fathom why they would have swapped them around if it wasn't that way. You know, I think they were they knew that it was a better bet basically to go with Durant in this instance. But it is really good, and so unfortunately things sort of tailed off a bit with the third one, and then it didn't go any further. I mean, whether Dark Man's got any further life in him, I don't know. I mean, this is, they've been released on Blu-ray and stuff, so more people have rediscovered them, and they're around. But I don't think there's any more. I think the scope for the character is quite limited, so I think there could be a nice reboot somewhere along the lines, but I think for me, Darkman 2 is probably the best in terms of viewer experiences, as far as I'm concerned.
A couple of interesting actresses pop up in this one.
Mm-hmm.
So we got Kim Delaney as this hotshot reporter trying to get the scoop on what's going on. I remember her from NYPD Blue, particularly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's been in loads and loads of stuff, of course. But the one I didn't recognise when I was watching it until I sort of popped it onto IMDb, Renee O'Connor plays the sort of the sister of the scientist, and she was Gabrielle in Xena Warrior Princess.
Yeah, because when was this? Was this made around the same time? Because this is a production from Renaissance Pictures, yeah. Sam Raimi's company, which also made Xena.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So I don't know whether this was the first thing they put her in, or whether they'd already worked with her and they decided to.
Xena was 95 to 2001.
Okay, so around the same time, basically. Yeah. Yeah. So she doesn't have a lot to do in this, does
Not
she?
Really,
I mean, her character is almost redundant. It's like, but yeah, it's nice to see her. And I thought you mentioned him earlier, Lawrence Dane as the scientist. Mm. He's got a really great presence. I've seen him in a couple of other things. He's one of those character actors who you know but you don't know the name of, and I've seen him in, I can't remember where I've watched him in other stuff that I've liked, but I was like, I like him and he's good and he's that weapons expert, because they do this whole thing where they're Durant wants to make these weapons and sell them. He's could do arms deals and stuff. He pulls it together very, very quickly.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, it's very good. Yeah, thoroughly enjoyable. It's available on Amazon Prime, as most of our DTV throwbacks are. No, actually, it's available to rent on Amazon Prime. This one.
Yeah, you can't. It's unfortunately not available as included in a membership. But you can get it on Blu-ray. And VOD.
Yep, absolutely. So, you know, if you're that way inclined and we've convinced you, go check it out. And that's the end of this week's show. So thanks, Rich, for delving into the Snyder's cut of Justice League and our Short Shot and Darkman 2.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, as usual. Don't forget to check out our other show. We will be putting out some new episodes soon of the Short Shots, where we look exclusively at short films. And don't forget to also check out the DTV Digest at Facebook and on Twitter, where we'll be putting out news of other releases and the DTV charts. So thank you for listening and tune in again soon.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.